262-605-6646.
Support for WGTD comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering both in-person and fully online sport management master's degrees. Learn business skills for today's fast-paced sports environment. Details at uwp.edu.
This is WGTD. You are listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Falkowski, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, this is Education Matters with your host, Jonathan Shaler. I'm a professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, where I founded and direct the certificate program in conflict analysis and resolution. I'm also founder and artistic director of the Shakespeare Prison Project at Racine Correctional Institution. That's a collaboration between the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. My guest today, my very first guest, is Dr. Anjali Joshi Brekke, professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Anjali is a PhD in communication. She earned that at the University of Washington. Her scholarship focuses on the potential and politics of listening and interweaves research from several traditions, including rhetorical studies, cultural studies, and sound studies. Her work explores the power and limitations of sharing personal narratives, both online and offline, to facilitate listening across difference. She's currently working on a book project based on an oral history and digital storytelling project that we'll be talking about. She led this to record and share stories of racial discrimination and resistance from the larger Seattle area. And she's published multiple works on podcasting, radical listening, and race, and teaches courses in community-based podcasting and digital storytelling. Anjali, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Yes, it's nice to be here with you. And we're going to have a great time, I know. I've been wanting to have this opportunity to talk to you for a long time. We teach in the same department, full disclosure,
yes,
at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and yet we have not yet had this kind of opportunity to speak in depth about your work, post-job interview. So I'm very excited about this and looking forward to it. And I know that our listeners will enjoy this too, because you have really so much to tell us about the importance of listening and storytelling and digital storytelling in the education process. So just to begin, if you could just give us a really brief biographical sketch about how you got here.
Sure. Grew up in Grand Forks, North Dakota, moved to Wisconsin at the age of nine. And it's there that I did, my K through 12. So I guess this is kind of a education history, but and then I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And then I ended up at the University of Washington, where I completed my PhD. And after completing my PhD, I got a job back in Wisconsin. So I'm really happy to be back here, close to family and community.
Wonderful. And as a fellow with the Center for Communication Difference and Equity at the University of Washington, you spearheaded a project to bring StoryCorps to the university. Could you tell us about StoryCorps and what that whole thing was about?
Yes. So StoryCorps is a organization that attempts to record stories from across the United States. So they have thousands and thousands of recordings from across the U.S., recordings of everyday individuals. So when we think of oral histories, we usually think of, important figures in history. But the goals of StoryCorps is really to document and record and archive in the Library of Congress stories between everyday Americans. So, you know, your grandmother, your family, and kind of get an understanding of the texture of America's landscape and cultural traditions and histories. And so to really archive the social histories of America. And they're a little bit different. You know, there's a debate, I guess we don't have to get into, about from oral historians of whether this constitutes oral histories, because they don't have, you know, traditional historians interviewing people. Rather, it's usually family members or friends interviewing each other about different aspects of their lives or something that they want to get recorded and archived. So it has a different feel. So some people prefer to call it, you know, a public memory project, sort of archiving the memories of Americans throughout the decades. And they have a lot of different projects, you know, for veterans, for the Latinx community, for the Black community. So they have a lot of different archives where they try to focus on making sure that a certain community is represented within the archive to get sort of the fuller texture of American history.
Beautiful. And do they have a standardized format?
The format is usually a 50-minute interview, and they have traveling booths, sound booths, where they go around and people sign up, and or at libraries. Often they'll partner with public libraries, and then they'll be in different towns throughout the United States, and people can go into their local library and have a conversation with their grandmother and get that archived. And they're usually, you know, 50-minute conversations, and they have a list of questions that you might want to ask. They do a big push around Thanksgiving, of when people are often with their families, you know, so they have the great Thanksgiving listen and things like that. But in our case, they also partner with organizations to record specific conversations that those organizations want to focus on. So in the case of our project, it was stories addressing experiences of racism within the Seattle area. And so that was sort of the focus of our digital storytelling project. And that StoryCorps came out both for sort of recording help at the time, as well as archival tools.
And I recall looking at your research and seeing that, if I'm not mistaken, that the conversations were primarily between women of color.
Yes. And so the article that I published about this really focused on some of our participants who were women of color. And so the majority of people who responded were women of color who wanted to tell their stories and discuss experiences. And one interesting finding we had, because the traditional StoryCorps model is interviews between people who know each other, you know, people who've been friends or family members for a long time. And we did get, you know, some couples, you know, some people who'd been married for a long time who wanted to talk to each other about their experiences. But we also got a lot of people who said that they didn't want to talk about racism with somebody they knew. They wanted to be paired with somebody, a stranger, essentially. Which was something that I hadn't been expecting when I started the project, because we let them choose, you know, who do you want to be paired with somebody? Do you have somebody in mind? Or would you rather be, you know, have us assign somebody to you? And a lot of people didn't feel comfortable talking about it with somebody that they knew, and that they actually wanted to be paired with somebody that had maybe experienced similar things to them or had a similar, you know, racial background, but somebody who was not somebody that they had an intimate interpersonal relationship with.
And did you come up with a theory or explanation for that?
One thing was, you know, for a lot of, so in the group, we had a lot of, you know, younger people, for example, who were from African diaspora communities. So maybe their parents had been refugees from Somalia or Eritrea, which is a large group of in Seattle of Eritrean and Somali Americans. And so I think for a lot of their parents' generation, especially for immigrant parents, the idea that, you know, I think they were perceiving racism in a different way. And, you know, and they were kind of, when their children would say, you know, I've experienced this, they were often not getting that kind of validation, or they weren't able to sort of communicate with their family because like the connection was a little bit too close, or they were. Things were, you know, assumptions were made based on having to know each other or having known each other for so long. And also with sometimes with close friends or people that you've known for a long time, it can be harder to discuss these painful experiences. But with, you know, I think the imperative to listen in a different way with somebody you've just met is a little bit greater because you don't know their history, right? You don't know their background. You don't know exactly where they came from. So you're going to ask questions. You're going to sort of feel that out in a different way. And so I think what the participants who chose to be paired with somebody else, I think they were looking for that sort of, they wanted to talk about these experiences, but they were having troubles in their interpersonal relationships discussing some of these experiences for various reasons. So I discussed one, which was having sort of the generational divide, as well as the sort of first generation, second generation divide. And so that was just one, but there were a lot of reasons I think that these conversations were difficult to have with intimate interpersonal others, as opposed to people that they were kind of coming to with a fresh slate. I think a common thread was sort of the idea of being free of some of the entanglements that we have with intimate others, of being able to talk about these difficult things with somebody that doesn't have preconceived notions about them.
That's very interesting. Thank you. So the title of your article based on this work is I Address Race Because Race Addresses Me. Women of Color Show Receipts Through Digital Storytelling. So maybe you could break that title down for us.
Yes, absolutely. So the first part is a quote from one of our participants who in the paper has given the pseudonym Gloria, who's a poet, a Black woman in her 70s and an educator for decades, one of the first Black women to earn a PhD at the University of Washington. So the quote, I address race because race addresses me, comes from an experience she had where a white woman was complaining about her poetry, that it only addressed racism and why doesn't she write about anything else? And so she went through her poetry collections and found that only 14% of all of her poems, so she actually documented it, addressed racism. And so it was a minority of the topics she covered in her poetry, which expressed different aspects of her life and her life experiences. And so that statement, I address race because race addresses me, was this idea that even when she wasn't, you know, when she was talking about different aspects of her life, or when she was trying to, she wasn't necessarily thinking about racism, it comes at her, right? So she's always having to react to other people's assumptions about her as a Black woman, to other people's filtering her stories and her words through this lens of their assumptions about her because she's a Black woman. It's not that she was solely fixated about race or racism. It's that when the reader of her poetry was reading her poems, they were filtering it through their own ideas about race. And so she was addressing their racism as opposed to her sort of being fixated on this one topic.
And so that was kind of one thing. Comment on that for a moment.
Yeah,
and then we'll get to
receipts. Sure.
It's interesting. I've been discussing your work with my 13-year-old son, and he's very interested and very bright. So we talked about this idea of addressing race because race addresses me. And also with Catherine, my wife, talked about the fact that, you know, as white people, one of our privileges is not having to address race. And so if you're a person of color, race is continually addressing you. You cannot escape it in a way. So that was a helpful conclusion, I think, for us to draw. I see you nodding, by the way. We're on the radio, so I just wanted to note that. So the receipts, what are those?
Yes. And so this is a term in Black colloquial culture, showing receipts. I mean, it comes from an interview with Whitney Houston with Diane Sawyer, where Diane Sawyer accuses kind of is pushing Whitney to talk about her drug addiction problems and says, you know, you spent so much money on drugs, and is kind of pushing her to disclose this personal information in this interview. And Whitney says, you know, show me the receipts, show me the receipts. And so she's asking, you know, if I bought all these drugs, show me the receipts. And so she's kind of pushing back on that invasion of her privacy, on that invasion of who she is, and kind of pigeonholing her as a single thing in that interview. And so that is sort of the origins of the term, but it's been developed, especially, you know, on Black Twitter and in other spaces, as a way of discussing sort of holding people in power accountable. So either by asking them to show receipts, so if they're making claims, to, you know, ask them to provide the evidence of the claims that they're making. If they're saying, say, we've done all of this to help these communities, or, you know, corporations say that are putting up messages that say Black Lives Matter while simultaneously engaging in anti-Black practices within their businesses. So that's people who are coming forth and saying, you know, show me the receipts, show me what you're actually doing to counter racism within your organizations. So that's one way in which showing receipts is being used. But the other way is actually the level of labor and documentation that many people of color have to do just to be able to be believed that this racism is happening. So we see a lot of what scholars call post-race discourse. So this idea that we are beyond racism, right? We elected a Black president, especially post-Obama, that racism is something behind us, that there's people that are continue to be fixated on it, but it's not something that's really an issue. The showing your receipts part is this idea that in order to be believed, people of color have to sort of meticulously document the experiences that happen to them and go through this additional labor to show that what they are experiencing, their lived experiences, are valid because they're not going to be believed without these receipts. So the show your receipts kind of goes two ways. One is sort of the pressure upon systems of power to show that they're actually doing what they say they're doing in PR statements. And then on the flip side, it's the labor that people of color often have to do to document that they are actually experiencing the things that they say they're experiencing.
Okay. So at the risk of getting myself in trouble, I'll play the role of the white male here and say, I detect a note of perhaps of resentment in having to do this work, that it shouldn't have to be done. That people of color shouldn't have to educate privileged whites, for example, in order to convince them that maybe something needs to be done in order to achieve equity. But my question about that is, if you don't tell the person in power exactly what is wrong, why would you expect them to believe that something's wrong? If that makes sense. Like, in order to correct something, don't we need the receipts?
Yes. And I think, you know, people of color are collecting these receipts, right? I think the resentment comes in all the lost opportunity, right? That they are having to spend all this time, right, to prove their value, to prove that what they're saying is true, that other people don't have to do, right? And this is, I did a interview series with a large corporation with their Black employees, as you know, and one of the employees from this tech corporation on the West Coast was just saying how, you know, she was experiencing all these sort of straight up aggressions, not even microaggressions, from colleagues, and that her work is being impacted by this racism within the workplace. But then in order to actually have HR, somebody address it, she has to go through this additional labor of collecting it and documenting it and showing it. And even then, it's still, you know, explained away. And so there's this, I think the resentment comes in that you know, people of color just want to do their jobs. They just want to be able to be successful like other people. And that instead of being able to do their jobs and do their jobs well, they're having to document these experiences and having to fight with HR to be able to be seen and to be able to make a living in a way that other people don't think about, or that other people are privileged in a position where that's not something that they have to deal with, so that their livelihoods are not compromised, their daily lives aren't compromised in the same way. And so I think that's where the resentment comes in.
Okay. So in order for a person in power to understand that, I still don't have an example. Could you give me an example?
Yes. So you mean like an example of something that might go on in the workplace or something that,
that
might
I might
on.
Have to, that someone might have to document in order to get some kind of response, hopefully, or change?
So for the example that of the woman that was that we were interviewing from this large tech corp, her colleague straight up said, I don't want to work with this woman. She's too angry. And she's a Black woman. And then that can be, you know, like she's too aggressive. And he told another colleague, you know, that she was too dark. So these are very, you know, very the trope of the angry Black woman is something that's been used against Black women for a long time. And that if a white colleague, a white male colleague had used the similar amount of, you know, similar communication tactics would not be called angry. He'd be called assertive or conveying leadership skills. And so I think there are both microaggressions like calling somebody angry when they're trying to express themselves.
Okay. I'm going to play the conservative pushback here and say, so I might be working closely with a colleague who I feel is not easy to work with because they're angry a lot. Can I raise that issue? You're saying that it was about race specifically, and we know that because he said to another colleague, she's too dark.
A lot of these microaggressions, if you take them as in isolation, they might not seem that big of a deal, or they might seem like they can be explained away in other ways. And I think that's where this kind of documentation, but when you've experienced it every day, right, where you're just trying to communicate your emotions, your frustrations, in ways that you see your colleagues doing every day, in even greater proportions, right? So you might see a white colleague, you know, yell at another colleague and have nobody question it because they maybe that person has greater power within the organization, and so they don't want to burn that bridge, or because they are seeing that communication style used by somebody who we're used to seeing it by, right? But then when a Black woman uses the exact same kinds of communication styles, she's seen as angry, and this can be documented, right? So for example, with the Supreme Court, this is in the case of Sonia Sotomayor, who's a Supreme Court justice. Male justices interrupt female justices at a much higher rate in general. So that's just a, you know, gender divide. But then if we see Sonia Sotomayor was one of the first female justices to really push back and interrupt at the same rate as male justices. And across the board, she was panned for being aggressive and overly assertive, right? But she was doing the exact same things her male colleagues were doing, right? But as a woman of color who's doing it, her actions are perceived differently. And so I think that's what's hard for people to understand, is that this differential treatment, right? And that you have to look at the whole picture. You can't just say like, well, yeah, I mean, she might have been angry though, right? Yes, she might have been, but she also, that's why she had to document all these other things that were going on, emails, conversations that this person had with other people that showed his racial bias was not, that it wasn't just that she was angry, it was that there were other things going on. And so I think that that's sort of the documentation that people of color, and especially women of color, often have to do.
Very interesting. Yeah, we could spend a lot of time on that, but we have other topics. So out of that same database, I believe there is a project, a book project that your colleague Relina Joseph is working on related to the experiences of mixed race school children, K through 12, and based on 36 interviews, there have been, you were involved in this. And I think we have a clip from this where Dr. Joseph, the founding and acting director of the Center for Communication Difference and Equity, is summarizing some of the important findings. So maybe we could listen to that and then you could comment on it. Just going to do a quick switch with my sound here.
How should issues regarding race and racism be handled in schools? Relina leans in as she tells me her three main takeaways from talking with the kids. Number one, listen.
So my hopes for the project are that schools will learn how to listen to all students differently.
We heard this desire loud and clear from the students.
Teachers, I want you to know, if you come across something that you don't know if it's right or wrong for a student to have said, I think it wouldn't be bad of you to go to a teacher of color and ask, or a person of color, or even go up to the student, because it's nothing wrong with asking. Like if a teacher came up to me and asked me, I would be like honored to tell you why that made me feel that way. So if you don't know, like, ask a question. Like, teachers preach that all the time. If you don't know, ask a question. So why don't you ask too?
Number two, address racism head on.
My hopes are also that schools will take anti-racist education more seriously.
In the classroom, this means teachers need to step up.
Do you think there's anything that white teachers can do to be an ally for kids of color that are feeling targeted racially?
I mean, like, they can probably stand up for them. Like, you know, use your privilege and, like, stand up for other people.
Yeah. What do you think that would look like in, like, a third grade classroom setting?
I mean, like, talk to the children who are probably being racist to other kids, you know?
Yeah, and have it be a part of your classroom dialogue.
Number three, hire more teachers and administrators of color.
You know, that's been also one of the themes that we've seen throughout, that when the students have had teachers of color and have had administrators of color, that's made a tremendous impact on them. And when they have had all white administrators, that's also made a very negative, tremendous impact on them.
So students want to see their identities represented in their teachers.
If the white quit the job, hire more black people.
If you're white, quit the job.
It's like, but no, like, you don't have to be black in order to teach some black kids. Like, you just have to know, like, what their life was like.
And the struggle.
Have some connections with them. Share the connections, like, and I think they should know about their own race.
So schools, here are three things your students need from you. Number one, listen to their experiences. Number two, address racism directly. And number three, hire more teachers and administrators of color.
So I think that we're really hoping that the teachers are gonna hear, the teachers are gonna listen to the stories that we're gonna be telling.
Nice. So, Anjali, tell us about this. What were some of the interviews like?
Yeah, this was a really fun project to work on. So Dr. Relina Joseph, who you heard there, wrote a whole book about this. So if you are an educator and are interested in thinking about how you can apply some of the lessons that we learned through talking to, you know, all of these K-12 students. It's called The Mixed Generation Mixed Goes to School. And it summarizes and gives useful activities. And it's part of a larger education series that focuses on, you know, on effective pedagogy. But some of the things we heard, and these students were ages 5 through 17, you know, so it was really a wide range of people interviewed. And a lot of the students you heard there were middle schoolers, because one thing that's kind of a side point, but is that middle schoolers are really honest. And so I find that middle schoolers, you know, elementary school kids are still trying to find the language, and high schoolers, I think, are a little bit more self-conscious. But I found that in, you know, having middle school age kids, they are sort of, before they get, you know, really become sort of get their adult self-consciousness, but they still have the language to describe sort of what they're experiencing. It's a really sweet spot. So if you ever have questions, you should go ask a middle schooler. So that is my advice to you, because okay. They are just so awesome. But yeah, so they were mixed race kids that were in K through 12 schools. And we brought them in just to kind of talk about some of their experiences. And a lot of them, so in the last clip you heard, was a brother and sister pair. So, you know, they'd kind of interview each other a little bit, and the researchers would interview them. And so it was fun to have them bounce off of each other and think about ideas about sort of how they're looking at things differently as siblings. So we had a lot of sibling pairs and families in the recording studio as well. And so that was interesting to sort of hear how different siblings experienced their educational life.
Great. And speaking of effective pedagogies, you've been doing community-based learning for a long time. Right now at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, you just wrapped up a course that focused on community-based learning, podcasting. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, and I believe you also have a clip.
So I am teaching every spring. I teach a community-based podcasting course. So I really love podcasting. I focused on oral storytelling in my dissertation. And so we've been working with the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective, which is trying to document Latinx histories or Latinx stories throughout the state of Wisconsin. And so they are pairing with the Wisconsin Historical Society to try to fill in this gap, really, of looking at how the Latinx community has contributed to the state of Wisconsin. So it's an exciting project that is filling, you know, a community need in terms of thinking about how do we think about Wisconsin's history and how Wisconsin has developed over time and what communities have contributed to Wisconsin's history. And so a quick note about Latinx, it's the term that our community partners use. So that's kind of the term that we use, but it is controversial within the community. And so always ask if you are meeting somebody how, you know, they would like to, what terms they use for their to describe their community. And so that's one of the things that we talk to the students about, is sort of like when you're working with community members that maybe have a similar background as you or a different background than you, how do you sort of navigate those similarities and differences? And how do you think about your own identity in relationship to the people whose histories that you're collecting? And so it's really fun to work through those ideas with students. And one of the things I love about Parkside is just the variety of students we have, right? We have students who grew up in rural environments. I've had some students say that they didn't really engage with people of color until they came to Parkside and, you know, gained different friends. And so I think that Parkside is a unique place because it has such a wide range of people with different experiences, people and with commuters from the Chicago area, commuters from the Milwaukee area, from Racine and Kenosha, as well as from the sort of nearby rural areas. And so we get a variety of students in the class. And so being able to navigate these differences and talk about them and kind of have fun thinking about how does our identities impact how we're interviewing people, how we're talking to people, and how can we learn through these differences and be able to embrace difference as a resource for learning, as opposed to something that we want to avoid talking about or something that is awkward, right? So we can kind of engage difference head on as a learning tool. What can, you know, folks who've grown up in rural areas teach us about, you know, about life that we might not understand having grown up in an urban area or vice versa, right? right? So I think there's a lot of great learning opportunities in the classroom, and community-based learning really allows us to engage in these in a way that makes an impact, right? Where the students say like, okay, I'm not just turning in a final project and doing it quickly before the deadline because I know that, you know, only one person's going to see this ever. But rather they're contributing to the history of the state of Wisconsin, which I think is impactful for a lot of the students.
Wonderful. I think I'm quoting you here from your article on radical listening. It's a bit of a mashup, but you had some wonderful language in there about exploring difference with curiosity and care, and also with a respect for the unknowable, which I thought was quite beautiful. Now, I think we have time for a clip from your listening party. And by the way, I don't think we've talked about what a listening party is yet.
Oh, yes. So this is something that we did. We did it with the K through 12 students for Generation Mixed. And it started with this idea with the original project we did with StoryCorps back in 2017. We had all these great stories that we'd recorded in the sound booth, right, between different individuals. And we wanted a way to bring the community into these dialogues and to be able to discuss sort of what people had experienced. So we started hosting these listening parties where people would get together, and one of my friends kind of dinged me for calling them parties because sometimes they can be kind of depressing. So they're not necessarily parties, but listening sessions maybe. And sometimes they're very joyous too, but where we'd bring together community members, invite members, you know, outside of the university setting as well, to come forward and eat food and drink good, you know, things and be able to discuss these issues sort of within a community space. So we'd play clips from the interviews, and then we'd have the storytellers come forward and kind of talk about the experience of engaging in these dialogues. And then we'd have sort of participation from the community kind of engaging on the process of listening and what it was like listening and points of resonance and points of disconnect. And
sounds so like that a was great really way of, yes, magnifying the impact of these stories. Yes. We have about 3 minutes left. Do we have time to play that clip?
Sure, I can. Let me set it up. Okay, I'm going to share a screen. And let me go ahead and we'll just play the first maybe 3 minutes of this clip. Does that sound good? Okay, here we go. Let me know if you can't hear it.
Okay. Sounds good.
My name is Josefina Ramon Chaires. I was born in 1946, January 2nd. My father's name was Reynaldo Ramon. My mother's name, Rita Ayala. Both of them were born in the state of Coahuila, Mexico, and they crossed over in 1914. They were both 2 years old, and they stayed in the city of Eagle Pass, Texas. Both of my parents were predominantly Spanish-speaking. Neither one went to school. My dad was illiterate. My mom could read and do math. My dad couldn't, but yet they both were gainfully employed throughout their life. How they did it, I don't know.
Josie spent the first 5 years of her life growing up in Texas, but that changed in 1951.
My dad got injured in the farm that we worked on, and he was told by the doctor, because he suffered a concussion, that he should not drive tractor anymore because the ground in Texas is so hard and that the jostling would be bad for him. Luckily, somehow he got wind of people that were going to come north. So my dad got together with this one family, and we came north in April of 51. We came in a truck, a covered truck, in the back with whoever, and I don't remember that. We could only bring the bare necessities, you know, because there were other families in this truck, and so we couldn't bring a lot. Whatever you could put in a bag, I guess, like a duffel bag.
Josie would grow up in Wisconsin, and it's here that she would eventually come to make a decision that would shape the rest of her life.
Probably the experience that had the most impact, in fact, choosing my profession as a teacher was that I went to a school. I started in a school where I was not allowed to speak Spanish. So I was mute all through kinder and first grade and second grade. I never spoke. All the teachers had to be white and no Spanish was allowed. And there was a system. You have to hear this because it's almost unbelievable. During recess, in order to make sure that you didn't speak Spanish, they would, some of our own, you know, Hispanic kids would be patrols. And if you were caught, they would walk around. And if you were playing jacks or whatever, if you were caught speaking Spanish, you would be reported. And the next time you came out for recess, you would get a bucket. And in that bucket, you would go around and fill it up with rocks from the playground. Not being able to speak Spanish, that always bothered me that I was not able to communicate that well. And I thought, well, you know, maybe one day there will be a classroom where you can go and you'll speak whatever you can speak.
I'm going to pause it there for time's sake. But Josie goes on to talk about, or as the students have edited her podcast, to talk about how that experience of not being allowed to speak Spanish really contributed to her own desire to become an educator and to be able to teach students. And later on, she had some great teachers that had some innovative teaching practices that inspired her as well to really go into education. And so the end of the podcast is an uplifting thinking about some of the ways that she's made a difference.
Wow, Anjali, this is fantastic work, really important. And the production qualities are so professional, very impressive. And, you know, it's interesting that your work with Latinx folk is transitioning to work with high school students in the Sanchez Scholars Program in Madison this summer. Can you say a word or two about that?
Yeah, I'm really excited. A teacher from Edgewood contacted me. Edgewood College in Madison, Wisconsin contacted me. He directs or is a part of the board of a group called Sanchez Scholars, which does college readiness for Latinx high school students. And so asked if I would be willing to do a podcasting workshop with them where they're going to, you know, learn interviewing skills and learn how and sound editing skills to be able to put together podcasts based on their life experiences. So I'm really excited to sort of meet those students this summer and be able to engage with them.
That's fantastic, Anjali. I mean, the work that you're doing is so important and so good for our community in terms of capturing these stories and helping people to raise their voices and to be heard, producing receipts, as you say. So, I mean, thank you so much for this interview. I think you've contributed a great deal in just this past 40 minutes, and I hope people reach out to you. And you're at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside, in the communication department. This has been an interview with Anjali Joshi Brekke, and my name is Jonathan Shaler, and this is Education Matters.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. You're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, yoga, movies, concerts, a beer garden, and more are offered by Kenosha County Parks this summer. For a calendar of events, visit parks.kenoshacounty.org or call 262-857-1869.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Gateway Technical College presents the Red Hawk Junior Fire EMS Camp. Students in grades 9 to 12 will train and experience what firefighters and EMTs do every day, June 20th through 22nd, gtc.edu.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, open every Saturday from 9 until 2 on 2nd Avenue, celebrating its 20th season with your favorite fruit, produce, prepared foods, crafts, and other handmade goods vendors. The original Kenosha Harbor Market. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Hello and welcome to Community Matters. I'm Jane Herring, and I'm really excited today that we're talking with the new executive director of the Kenosha Public Museums. And we're going to learn a little bit, of course, about the museums, but even better, going to learn a whole lot about Leslie Brothers, who is the new executive director. So welcome to the program, Leslie.
Thanks, Jane.
And I know this is a welcome back to Kenosha because you grew up here. We're going to talk a little bit about your memories of Kenosha and what might have changed over the years. But it's important to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about when we say the museums, the Kenosha museums. So perhaps, Leslie, you can start with that and tell me what you're responsible for.
So, Jane, I just want to say, for fear of